one, because there is a lot of gaps in this.
He's on the verge of a breakdown.
What got into him? See, look, yes.
Oh, yeah, there is additional dialogue that they put in there to these things, non-canon dialogue
It's non-canon,
It's all this non-canon dialogue going into the... Our photo novel's canon.
This is side canon thoughts.
Yeah, indeed.
But yeah, there's loads of thought balloons.
Yeah, do we count the thought balloons as canon? Because this is supposed to be a...
That's an episode in itself, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
We'll have to... Once we've gone through the hall.
A discussion about photo novels.
Yes, we will. You know. Yeah, I mean, certainly...
Our photo novels canon.
Yes. That's a great idea. Okay. All right, then. Well, I think we'll begin, then, if you chaps are agreeable.
I think we've already got our...
We're already recording, so... I mean,
we've already fired our opinion gland.
Indeed, yeah. You all right, Dead Dog Boy? You ready to go?
I just remember the Plumic Soup.
Plumic.
Plumic Soup.
Here we go. Well, why don't we just spend the whole podcast just reading
Let's read it out. Let's do the dialogue.
Yeah. Excellent. Right, well, hello and welcome to another edition of Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. My name is Terry DeFellon, and I'm the host, and I'm joined by... I've got the football on, haven't I?
You have, yeah.
We'll have to start again.
it's okay when we do this during the Sound of Football, but...
Yeah, but we can do it during Star Trek.
Not really.
Not Star Trek. If we've got Star Trek on, that's another
thing.
You
could have just muted it. I mean, that would have been fine.
Oh, yeah, it's fine. It's fine. It's a pre-season friendly.
Yeah, so, sure. For sure.
What was that?
Yes, it was Norwegian.
I think it was just kind of North Europe. It's a generic North European accent. Yeah.
But it wasn't as bad as a Swedish chef.
It's Western Baltic.
Western Baltic. It's
Western Bull something. Yeah.
Hanseatic, that's what it is.
Ah, very good. Very good. Very good. Hello. There seems to be noise everywhere.
Mm. So some angle grinding in the rain.
It's a conspiracy. Right. Let's start again.
What is this? Trying. If I want anything from you, I'll ask for it.
Captain, I should like to request a leave of absence on my home planet. On our present course, you can divert to Vulcan with a loss of but 2.8 light days.
Oh, what the devil is this all about?
I have made my request, Captain. All I require from you is that you answer it, yes or no.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast with me, Terry DeFellon, and with my friend Derek Mantle.
Hello.
And with my other friend, Graham Sibley. This episode, we're going to be talking about a classic Star Trek episode from the original series, and that is A Mock Time. A Mock Time originally intended to be a first season episode, but it took so long to write that it ended up becoming... a second season episode, the first one coming off. I don't think it was the first one produced. I think Cat's Ball was the first one produced.
Yeah, it was definitely the first one screened.
But it was the first one screened. But yeah, initially intended to be included in the run towards the end of the first season. And I did actually want to have a quick chat about that.
Yeah.
Because there is a clear, for me, there's a distinction in terms of the music changes a lot. And also, I think that the direction... the pictures, I think the second season feels and looks ever so slightly different to the first season. The first season is, for me, a little bit more of an earthier experience. And I wonder whether or not you think that program, how it would have been if there'd been, like, you know, a first season feel to A Mock Time.
I mean, that makes perfect sense, because I actually thought about A Mock Time that I thought it was a funny thing to start the series in, because it is... obviously in series you would have like a big break, and you know, there'd probably be repeats on an American TV. I don't know how it worked over there. And I thought it was quite strange to have this as the first episode. And you're right, it does look very different. It looks the whole thing, the sets are more colourful. I think the design itself, it reminded me of some of those 1960s book covers very sparse, and you know, but also trying to be very alien anyway. You know, I mean, it is Vulcan.
Yeah.
But no, it did have that feel. It did have, I mean, the first series did seem to be more standard, more, you know, as you said, earthy or militaristic sort of thing. It's like the Navy in space and so on here. And running straight into an episode like this, which is going into about, the whole feel is about emotions and you know, different cultures and, you know, different ways of a whole different perspective. You know, like alien civilizations. It's it has a completely different sort of feel to it.
Yeah,
you're gonna ignore.
I am. I'm afraid. Yeah. I mean
too much into it.
Well, I looked at this and I looked at it for the first time as thinking, right, well, this was the first episode of the second season, and actually thinking about it, well, what would I have seen here if I hadn't been seeing an episode of Trek for a few months or so? But I actually think it's a really, really good opener. For a second season, and it's almost like it's in some ways like a pilot for the rest of the season. You've got the introduction of a new character, you've got Chekhov there, and he gets a good, not a powerful role within the story, but he gets a lot of lines. He's actually used, and there's a great bit of interplay between him and Sulu, sort of bringing Sulu more into the
first we're going to Altair.
Yeah.
Then we're going to Vulcan. Then we're going back to Altair.
But yeah, you get that with those two, and it's actually quite interesting because obviously, like, Chekhov is because of the way the set is actually set up. The way he sits is actually right at the front of the forefront of the shot. And usually they've got some bit part actor coming in and sat in that seat. So at least now you've got an actual someone that you've got that gets lines, gets a bit of conversation, actually gets a conversation in their own little scene. I think it's very, very rarely. I can't remember of a single time in the first series where you'll have got a conversation between officers that weren't Spock, McCoy, and Kirk.
Mm. Yeah, that's like, I mean, maybe if you go back to the really early episodes,
yeah,
when, like, for example, The Man Trap, where you had supporting cast,
yes,
what we would describe as a supporting cast now,
yeah,
you know, having their own scenes,
yeah,
like Janice Rand and Sulu and the funny plump that was basically a plump, strange-looking glove during The Man Trap. Where you've got a shift away. And funny, because that's the first ever episode. And if you've been watching it for the first time, you'd have thought, well, this is how the show is going to be.
Yeah.
And in fact, it doesn't go down that road.
I suppose a lot of the other ship-based episodes were stuff like Charlie X. Maybe there's stuff in there as
well.
Yes,
yeah, that's true, yeah. I mean, I think when Janice Rand was around,
yeah,
because I think that there was plans that she was going to be quite a major character in the show.
Yes.
And it's reflected in some of the sort of like preliminary scripts that are
and the promotion material as well. It was three plus her, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, in a lot of occasions, yeah. She was in that. Obviously, that's not what happened. They made a decision to not do that, which we won't go into here. But that's interesting. If the Amok Time had been a late first season episode, if it had come out around the same time as City on the Edge of Forever or Operation Annihilate, which is when it was sort of supposed to be, then Chekhov obviously wouldn't have been in that at all.
No.
And you're right, he does play a prominent, albeit peripheral role. He doesn't do anything of any genuine value.
No.
But he's given a lot of screen time.
Yeah.
I wonder whether or not that's why they actually, that's the reason why they used that episode as the first one. Because if I am understanding it correctly, Chekhov was used... I didn't think we'd be talking about Chekhov as much in this episode. Because, I mean, it's about Spock. But anyway, we'll talk about Spock in a minute.
Yeah.
Chekhov was introduced because they wanted to appeal to a younger audience because he was kind of, he looked a little bit like one of the monkeys, I think.
Yeah.
And
any of them.
any of them. They all genuinely look the same, apart from the bloke with the hat.
Yeah. And I think they're also doing the Man from U.N.C.L.E. thing as well.
And exactly. There's a bit of that going on. They're cashing in on all of that, try so it was important. I thought, well, this is quite good because he's got lots of screen time early on. So let's bring this one in and actually make this episode the first one to introduce Chekhov.
So as I say, like a pilot for the second season.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it would have been quite different had it been a first season episode.
Sure,
I think it's fair to say. I mean, in essence, it wouldn't have been. But who knows, the decisions, because needless to say, this episode was quite heavily rewritten. most episodes of Star Trek are quite heavily rewritten. Mm-hmm. It was written by a chap called Theodore Sturgeon, who has written had written a previous episode of Star Trek called Shore Leave, and wrote a treatment for a subsequent episode of Star Trek which never got made called The Joy Machine. A very, very prominent science fiction writer, but not used to working to TV deadlines, and was just incredibly late with the script, which is why it got brought over to the second season. And it was heavily rewritten by Dorothy Fontana. Although Sturgeon was given the option to make some changes, which he subsequently did. They asked him to change the Christine Chappell's role in the episode was not there. It was actually going to be a character called Maggie, I think, who was going to act as this kind of somewhat slight love interest, mm-hmm. extra dimension to Spock's blood fever, to his problem, his illness. But they decided to use Christine because they thought they'd call back to the Naked Time, where she professes feelings for him, and at the same time being a slightly more mature actress and a mature character, they felt that it was more appropriate. And Theodore Sturgeon was quite happy to do that and make these changes. But then, as in the end, it was Dorothy Fontana who I think sort of like gave it the polished treatment and finished it off, and we have what it is now.
It's a very tight script. I mean,
isn't
it? When I was watching it, there's so much actually in how many minutes is it? Like, 45 minutes or so.
I think it's certainly more than that. Let's get into some of the sequences that there are. The other thing that slightly jars about it being a season opener, if you're new to Star Trek, you wouldn't necessarily appreciate Spock's behaviour early in the show, would you? If this was a show you'd never watched before.
That's the thing that got me. You see, that's why I think that it's very different.
Well, I suppose it depends on whether you're looking at it as something like as a season two opener or actually a cold. It's not actually a pilot, is it? It doesn't really introduce the characters in the way that you're going to know them, or they anticipate you're going to know them. But I think. It's interesting that you say that, because really this is one of the most memorable episodes of the whole series, and it's probably the most parodied episode.
Yeah, definitely, I would say.
So it offers so much to what has gone on afterwards, and people have drawn in ideas, even if for not parody, even like for straight science fiction, has drawn back from the elements that are in this episode.
So it's I mean, I'm sure listeners are right across a mock time, but essentially it's Spock has to go back to his planet Vulcan to mate, otherwise he's going to die, because the sexual urges are so great that he's
going to explode.
Simply cranking up the tablet getting out the Kleenex box is just not enough. It's just not going to do it. So he has to go back, and Kirk has to defy orders in order to send him there. And of course, as we know, there's a dramatic conclusion in which Spock feels that he thinks that he, due to chicanery by McCoy, Spock thinks he's killed his best friend. And he hasn't, because McCoy has duped him, and everything's fine, and they all go off. The Vulcan scenes. This would be a good time to talk about the remastered. No matte paintings.
No.
Because in this episode, even in the original, there was no matte painting. Lots of close-up shots in the original episode of the place of marriage and challenge.
But that lovely large set, though.
It must have been
a big soundstage that they actually recorded that on.
I reckon so, yeah. Derek is showing us a picture of it here on the photo novel, which you'll be delighted because, of course, we have the photo novel of it. The remastered version, they stretched that sequence out a little bit more. I think they actually edit the music as well slightly. And there's a sequence from when Kirk and Spock and McCoy arrive, beam down, and then they walk across the bridge to the place of marriage and challenge, and there's a big wide shot of them walking across this bridge, and it's the same bridge that we see in Star Trek 3 and Star Trek 4.
This is the land of my family. been held by us for more than 2,000 Earth years. This is our place of Kunut Khalifi.
And it's a nice call back or call forward to those movies.
Retconning.
It is retconning. Yeah, it is retconning. Yeah, and in that respect, it's despicable. But it is also at the same time very nice. Do you got anything to say about that?
Well, I can't say anything more except yeah, it's very nice. I did like the subtle effects of seeing the. If you look closer, you can see the Vulcan city in the.
Yeah, because it's really high up, so you can see this city in the distance. And it gives it's nice world building. That's for me. That's where the remaster. I think these remasters work really nicely because it the transition's really nice. It suits it. It's really good. I mean, it is clever. I mean, the people who did these remasters, they obviously know the subject extremely well. They know what they're doing, and it's added to the authenticity. I think it did really well. There are other occasions when you think, well, why did they need to do that?
I think the picture of T'Pring as a child is completely redone as well. Yeah. And the background of that, I think, took elements from a set from a Next Generation episode.
Is that right?
I think it did. Okay. Yeah. So
I don't know how I feel about that. Mm. But, yeah, I mean, so one day we'll do a podcast on the remasters. Maybe when we've exhausted TOS and we're sort of like, you know, really drilling down, we'll go into that and the rights and wrongs and where we think it is a good thing and where we think it isn't a good thing. I would like to talk about that sequence on the Enterprise between Spock and Nurse Chapel when she goes into his quarters while he's asleep to. Tell him.
Very stalker.
She's a medical professional.
I know.
Yeah, she's a medical professional.
She has access to all of these places.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
She doesn't abuse her position.
She completely, doesn't respect Spock's wish for privacy at all. Yeah. Spock, when he wakes up, though, I mean, what do we think's going on here? Do you think Spock's making the move on Christine? Because at this point,
Miss Chapel.
Yes, Mr. Spock.
I had a most startling dream. You were trying to tell me something, but I couldn't hear you. It would be illogical for us to protest against our natures, don't you think?
I don't understand.
Face is wet.
Do you think that he wakes up and his reaction, he says, I've had the strangest dream.
Yeah.
And at this point, he doesn't know that actually he's going to Vulcan.
And
he thinks he's going to have to stay.
Yeah.
And he's going to have to make the best. And do you think that he is trying
preparing
to seduce
the ground, yes.
Christine Chapel in that moment?
Probably. Probably he's just in a hormonal haze. I think
he has enormous wood.
Well,
he's got Vulcan wood.
Whatever's
well, that's why he's
whatever
sits
version
there.
Of
well, that's why
you know, testosterone is flying around of his Vulcan gonads around
test,
his
yeah.
test screen drone.
Like, yeah.
But you do notice when he's actually sitting there by himself with that
playing his lyre. Yeah, I think that was a metaphor.
Yeah, that was a considerable. that didn't even escape me, and I'm terrible at interpreting these kind of things. It's funny, isn't it? Because I mean, I remember watching this when I was quite young, and I think probably some of the subtext was lost on me. And over the years, when I've watched it, I've never really rethought about some of these things. But then looking at it, thinking, yeah, you know what? I wonder what would have happened, or what would have happened if Christine had just kept her mouth shut. You should have gone, actually, do you know what? I might just say nothing. I'll just say nothing and see where this goes. Here we go with it.
Yeah.
He's not kicked me out. He's not thrown a bowl of soup at me. I'll just hang here, see what happens. And then, like, you know, afterwards, I say, oh, by the way, we're going to Vulcan.
You would think, because he's half human, that the sort of like, and also his father has also had, relationships with his mother, who was human.
Yeah.
That there must be some...
Yeah.
There is a way
this is kind of retconning, though, isn't it? Because, yeah. I mean, we know that Spock is half-human because it does seem fair. He does say that in the episode. He actually mentions it.
Yeah.
He said he'd hoped that he would be spared us. Yeah. So I guess that could have been what he was thinking. He's thinking, you know, I mean, my dad married a, you know, my mother's human, so I'm half-human. So, yeah, why not? Why not, you know, why not do that? And, you know, Christine seems to be willing. So she's happy to take my abuse. So therefore, you know,
I mean,
you know, not
in,
sure
in fan said. Fiction, you know, there's a big thing about sort of Kirk and Spock.
Well, it's not called Kirk / Spock. That is where / fiction originated. Yeah.
So obviously, it's the other way when
Spock / Christine / Kirk / McCoy.
But when they're actually fighting,
you've delved into this a bit too far. Yeah.
It's fair to say my research took me to some dark corners of the internet. Let us quickly pull it away from that, lest we, you know,
withdraw.
We truly upset her. Let us withdraw quickly. Sorry,
well, before our own hormonal imbalances take
it's
over.
It's an episode about sex. Come on, we can drop in the odd double entendre.
Yeah.
There's also
sex and infidelity. It's a big bit there, really.
Well, let's talk about that now. You mean the whole Ston to Pring thing?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of like, you know, he's been away for how many bloody years?
Yeah.
Since she was...
So, I mean, do you think to Pring sort of like, you know, do you think she's right to think, well, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to marry you. I want to, you know. I think
she explains it perfectly herself. Really, yeah. I mean, like, you know, she does everything that is perfectly logical.
Yeah.
Wonderful bit of game theory in there as well.
Go on.
Well, the way she actually decides that she will choose Kirk. To be a champion, so that she wins either way.
Yeah. And she must have worked that out on the spot. Yeah.
And not putting her lover in the position that he would actually get
she
hurt.
She thought, hang on a second.
I think she may have done that with anyone really, but to say, you know, that.
Do you think that maybe she thought, at the moment, she thought, oh, hang on, he's brought mates. I'll get one of them in. Or do you think maybe she was thinking, she said to Ston, this is what's going to happen. You're going to fight him.
Yeah.
You're going to win, and that's going to be that. But then maybe she's thinking this.
Well, that's what Ston thinks the plan is, isn't it?
So yeah,
he's
duped Ston.
Yeah.
Yeah. But maybe she's deep down, she's thought, well, you know what?
If he brings
a couple of guys to, then I'll pick one of them. Because this Ston bloke, he's all right. But, you know, he's a bit rubbish with the old.
He's got bigger ears than Spock.
Yeah, they're not as convincing ears.
Yeah,
the Spock ears.
Yeah.
The ceremony itself, governed by T'Pau. Now she's a woman you don't want to push too far.
No.
She's brilliant.
Yeah. She is brilliant, and the thing is as well, she lays it down first line she gets, because like it's first line she actually pronounces Spock's name in such a way that it says, right, okay, well, yeah, you're Vulcan now. Yeah.
Spock.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, oh, okay,
who's this Spock guy? McCoy's going, who's this Spock guy?
Do you know much about the actress? Because I found out that she was married to Peter Lorre.
I didn't know that.
So she came over from with Peter Lorre.
Yeah, she is English. Was English. Yeah, yeah.
Well, she was born in Vienna.
She's born in Vienna.
So she was. But I think another example, because same as we had in the previous podcasts about Journey to Babel, another example of Star Trek using Austrian actors to come up with a nice alien accent.
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course. Yeah, yeah, because it is quite North European, I suppose, isn't it? Yeah, it's. I mean, she is amazing. Unfortunately, I didn't write down her name, and I haven't made any notes, so I don't know whether or not. Is it there? There we go. Celia Lovsky. So yes, played by the lovely Celia Lovsky.
I'd be quite interested to find out what. You know, obviously, she came over with Peter Lorre, and who became a big film star during the 40s. Obviously, whether she appeared in any major sort of movies as well.
Well, my impression that I got was that she was a well-established actress, a veteran actress, and that they were done well together. But perhaps I'm wrong. I mean, she certainly knew. Yeah, she did this very well. She nailed that superbly, and she looks great on her. High chair, isn't she? She's being chairlifted.
Yeah, let's have a look at that chair.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they're definitely something from the prop department that they've sort of just chucked together a couple of bits of wood, but not too bad.
And the guy who played Stom was in Balance of Terror too, as a Romulan.
Yeah.
So along with Mark, yes. Mark Leonard has
he's
played.
He's the guy who wanted to permit me the glory of the kill, isn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
he also wore one of those helmets as well that the Vulcans were wearing. Is that right?
Yeah, I think there was. I have a feeling that those helmets that some of the Vulcans were wearing in order to cover their ears so that they didn't have to have the makeup done may well have been actually Romulan from Balance of Terror. Yeah. It wouldn't be a surprise.
And okay, going back to a previous podcast, they are definitely a sight better than those bloody Smurf hats that they wore in
Star Trek 4.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm
wouldn't
sorry.
That have been
I
funny
can't...
if they'd done that. The next time they remaster them, they're going to put those stupid Smurfs, or they're going to remaster Star Trek 4 and put those Romulan helmets on them. It'll be something along those lines. What do we think about those funny jangly things that they keep wearing?
Ridiculous.
I found those ridiculous. I have to say.
They were just stupid.
Well, yeah,
and
yeah.
They were a bit 60s, I suppose, sort of like nice like hexagonal tambourines, but no, ridiculous.
Are they sort of like, are they to sort of like encourage fertility? Are they sort of like,
They look like a cross between Christmas dream catchers.
Yeah, that's where I'm going with it.
Well, I actually thought they were sort of Norwegian, sort of reindeer, sort of
that as well. I think, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. They could, couldn't they?
They look a bit like,
they're
a bit Sammy.
Yeah,
Sammy.
The goal.
Maybe that's where those bloody hats come from.
Sammy hats. Yeah,
the goal.
Yeah. Nice
the Vulcan
sound.
Gong makes a great sound, albeit somewhat unconvincing.
Yeah.
I don't believe that gong made that sound.
You do not think?
It's a lovely design.
Call me naive, but I'm pretty certain that that's
so
not
you say, there's work. A bloke sort of oiled up behind there, like on the rank.
Like the rank guy, yeah. Yeah.
Like, timing away. It's obviously not. It's obviously electronically produced, like from around that lovely auditorium there. And that's just like some kind of like pad, isn't it?
There's probably a guy around the back who's got a mixing desk, and there's speakers positioned around the entire chamber.
Are you saying that was actually a drum machine? Like
I think it was. Yeah, it was a hanging drum machine. That's what it was.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah,
so it was hooked up to
to
a speaker.
Probably Bluetooth, actually. Around to the whole side.
Yeah,
you know, this
is
23rd century.
It is the 23rd century. I mean, they've got to have Bluetooth in the 23rd century, haven't they? Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, you would have had to be there for like half an hour trying to get it, trying to get the gong to connect to the speakers. It's not recognising it. Hold it closer. Have you connected it before? Yes.
Have you got your Bluetooth on?
Let me try.
Bloody communicators. Turn them off. Put them onto airport.
Yeah. There's a Swear Trek gift there. Just waiting
definitely.
For you.
Definitely. I'd like to just quickly talk about the music.
You have to.
Because it's an original soundtrack. And as I say every time we cover an episode which has an original soundtrack, only roughly 35% of the original series had original scores. The rest of it was all tracked, so it was all reused by the music editor, who did a very, very good job. It has to be said, doing that. This is one of those ones which got an original score. Mm-hmm. Gerald Fried, who had done plenty of stuff for Star Trek before, in relative terms, plenty of stuff, and he did this. And we use the term iconic too much these days, but I think that genuinely applies to the score used in Amok Time.
No, this is true. This is a genuine cinematic score.
Yeah.
Because it's got everything. It's got all the things you want in the score. It's thematic. You've got the big action scene, but you've got the hooks from there in throughout the whole of the episode.
Yeah. And you've got also the fight scene music. Yeah. Which was reused and reused to such
and
a
not just in this series,
and not just in Star Trek.
Yeah, Ace Ventura.
Futurama, and The Simpsons, of course.
Cable Guy.
Is it used there as well?
Oh, yeah. Is it Cable Guy?
Maybe
it was Cable Guy rather than Ace Ventura. What's Jim Carrey? In The Simpsons, it's used in the episode. It's probably used more than once in the series.
It's definitely used
In the episode where Homer goes into space, while he's during the NASA trials, there's a mock-up of the Games of Triskelion.
Yes, with Barney.
with Barney, and they're fighting each other in the whole I bet 400 quatloos on the newcomer.
Yeah.
Which of course from Games is a Triskelion, which is using track music from a Knock Time. But they also use it in an episode of The Simpsons when Santa's little helper is unwell and the pet store owner attempts to do a mind meld. And they use the bass Spock's theme from it.
That's a great bit of music.
Yeah. That is, well, the bass player was none other than Bill Kessel, who is, blank looks, fair enough, a famous and noted jazz bassist of his time. And recorded many studio albums and are celebrated, and they got him in to do it.
I presume that he probably worked on The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and stuff like that as well.
That's a good question. I don't know.
Because there was that fashion of bringing the electric bass into a lot of
Mission Impossible.
Well, that could be a connection there. It's worth
going back to James Bond, with John Barry stuff.
But you wouldn't have got many super talented bass players around, in fairness. Yeah. I know Hollywood had a lot of talented people, but I mean, it would have been session work for him, and he came in and he did it, and he did the whole boom, 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 really, really good. So, a nice bit of trivia there, particularly for jazz fans who will maybe appreciate that. Nice.
Yeah. Yes. Also talking about the parodies and also where the music's been used, it was used in that Futurama episode that was a complete copy of the homage to A Mock Time.
Is that Zoidberg returning?
Yeah, when Zoidberg goes back to his
episode. What's the episode called?
It's Why Must I Be a Crustacean in Love.
It's
season 2, episode 5. And it is brilliant. It's a brilliant episode.
Yeah.
And
I sat down and watched it yesterday.
Yeah. I so did I. Yeah, just because it works so well,
and there's like Zoidberg.
It's a great Zoidberg episode. Zoidberg is fantastic.
We're going to wrap soon. I think there's one more thing that I wanted to just raise and see if you guys have got any opinions that you want to offer on that. And of course, if you've got anything else that you think needs to be said about this episode that hasn't been said, then now is the time to say so.
Well, I'm actually going to go back to the actress. Is that? We actually forget that, obviously Star Trek's brilliant with bringing in lots of people from, different minorities. Is actually T'Pring. She's a beautiful actress, but she was a mixed race actress as well, African American actress.
Was she really? Arlene Martel? I wasn't aware of that.
But, if you look at it again, you can see that she's, a high proportion of people from lots of different nations and cultures in Star Trek. It's brilliant.
They probably thought that she looked sort of exotic, I suppose.
It's interesting. In her other roles around the same sort of time, she was quite often playing spies.
Oh, was she?
Yeah.
Eastern
European or Russians or Mongolian type of thing.
Yeah.
Well, she does have wonderful cheekbones.
Yeah.
She does indeed.
But startling woman as well. Yeah.
Mm. Indeed. Anyway, I think the final point I wanted to do about this is obviously a very important episode for Star Trek because it's a heavy Spock episode. We learn an awful lot about Spock, about Vulcan, about there's lots of world building. Is there also a further advancement of the trio of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, mm-hmm. the friendship and that they have between the three of them? I think really takes a big step forward in this episode because Kirk has to risk his career in order to get Spock to Vulcan. He doesn't really truly probably understand why. It's been explained to him, but it's probably not something that he genuinely understands. So he's going out on a limb. And McCoy, very much in on that. Kirk confides with McCoy. McCoy figures out what's going on. McCoy and Spock invites McCoy along to help out, and then McCoy plays a decisive role in getting Kirk and Spock out of this impossible situation where they have to fight to the death.
Yeah.
So it really is. This is an establishment episode of that trio working it together as officers, but also as friends. Even though Spock and McCoy have this thing, the closeness of their friendship.
It was
their
a
connection.
Funny way. I mean, obviously, you had Kirk has, Spock has invited Kirk to go with him, like to second him to, you know, onto Vulcan. But it was a funny way that sort of when you have in the turbo lift, you had McCoy still dressed up in his medical, you know, surgery gear. And it's sort of like Spock tries to make that bridge over, and it was a very awkward moment, sort of saying, "Oh, you can come along if you want, mate."
It's like your first.
The whole thing is awkward. The whole circumstances are awkward thing, anyway. Yeah. So, yes. But and I think they bring that across because there are a couple of scenes in lifts, and lifts are always awkward places. And the first thing with Kirk and Spock is brilliant when Kirk is just going, "I don't understand what's going on here." And he brings it across really, really well. I think that going back to the photo novel, which something we spotted earlier, was this photo novel has a hell of a lot of thought bubbles in it. It's got it and it shows what that sort of thing, although we think rather the it's so well scripted, but it is also not scripted in a lot of the time. It lets the gaps in between there speak volumes.
And so I think whoever adapted this photo novel is going, this is not coming across with just the pictures.
And it's the actors' direction.
I think
it's really good. I mean, we've already seen that as the case. They've even got a thought bubble on the front of the
Spock must kill me if he
That's a splendid dramatic reading. It's got to be said there, don't
worry. But it's a thought balloon. I mean, even then, he's actually acting as Kirk.
Yeah, he's in out in
his brain.
His thoughts are out of
brain. Right, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's wonderful, isn't it? Yeah. There's a nice little note, actually, by DeForest Kelly.
I was looking at that. I was actually looking at the signature.
Interesting what you say about Bones getting a much bigger role in there, because this was the first screened episode with his name was billed in the opening credits.
Yes.
Oh,
absolutely.
So, and although he had been, the three were well established as the three main characters, this is obviously a time when he's actually gets that official recognition at the start of the show.
Absolutely. So it is a good... It's good that this episode. This is a great season opener.
It's a great ground.
It's a brilliant episode. It's a great season opener, and I think it would have been diminished if it had actually been an end of season, first season.
Yeah.
It would have had trapped music, and it's possible. And it wouldn't have had the Chekhov thing. And it might well have been that they would have scaled back on Bones a little bit more, and that would have been a different show.
Imagine it nowadays. Imagine if this is being shown today. Imagine what social media would be like after that first episode of the second series. You think about how it would have been trailed and how it would have been gone out. We've just had the first episode of Game of Thrones come out, and you can see the amount of the social media traffic and everything that's generated. What would this have done if this had been in similar circumstances? An episode like this coming out just like that.
Funny enough, you say about that, because at the moment we've just come to the end of the comic convention, the big one in
San Diego.
San Diego. And obviously Game of Thrones is out the first week of that and so on. And what I read was that with regards to AMOC time, it was actually shown before the actual broadcast at a science fiction convention.
Wow.
And there was a lot of fan reaction sort of saying, you know, they knew that there was going to be an episode on Vulcan because Spock had built up.
Because
it's the first one set on Vulcan. In fact, it's the only episode set on Vulcan. So tremendous excitement about that. And if it was then showcased at a con, wow, that would have been
brilliant.
Imagine being in that room. Mm. Wow. Well, I think that's time enough to. I think we can finish up. Well, I think we can finish up there. Apologies for those of you who are disappointed that neither Derek or Graham missed my T'Pau pun, but when they listen back, they'll pick it up.
As long as you don't bring out your records as well.
See, that doesn't work on me anymore.
No, I know it doesn't.
And you still missed the pun. It doesn't make up for the fact that you missed the pun.
It just fell on sandy ground.
It did indeed. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Well, in that case, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for listening. Whompodsdestroy.com is the website. And you'll find links there to our... I was about to say Facebook page, but we famously don't have a Facebook page. But our Twitter account is there, our Instagram is there, and indeed our all-important feeds for you to subscribe to and leave us, you know, 5-star reviews and say how brilliant we are. All there, whompodsdestroy.com. We'll be back shortly, but, you know, in a couple of weeks' time or so, where we'll be continuing on our discussion slightly about, not this episode necessarily, but about its writer, Theodore Sturgeon, and his contemporaries as we discuss the new wave of science fiction writers in the 1960s, and specifically with those who wrote for Star Trek, the original series. So until then, from myself, Terry Fallon, and from Graham Sibley, and from Derek Mantle, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.